Okay, good afternoon. Small group of people, almost like Christmas. I wonder why. Okay, this is the last lecture. Welcome to this last lecture. It's a lecture that is going to talk a lot about a methodology rather than an area of linguistics like semantics or pragmatics or syntax. It's a methodology that you can use to do linguistics of all sorts. You can do pragmatics with corpus linguistics, you can do phonetics with corpus linguistics, etc. It's one of several methods, or one of several methodologies. It's the one that several of my colleague and myself are employing a lot for our own research and also for teaching purposes. So it's quite likely, it's not necessary, but it's quite likely that you're going to meet with that methodology again later in the course of your student career. So that's why I felt it is a good idea to introduce you to some of the principles quite early on. Okay, before I do this, I'd like to say a few words about the exam, because one or two people might be interested in this. Just a reminder, you need to register in LSF. If you haven't done this yet, the deadline will be 4 weeks before. I haven't actually calculated what the deadline is, but just make sure you don't miss it. Okay. Remember, you have to do, and I don't know what you need to do for the other lectures, you need to do the assignments for the lectures. They're the necessary assignments. Okay. So if you're a BA and you haven't handed it in, a BA student haven't handed it in here at this in this lecture, then you're in trouble. You need to contact me. I have now, well, I'll say something about the assignments later. Reminder of the time and date, I hope I got this right, Monday 26th of March in the morning, 10:15. We are in three different lecture theatres. We will then sort of make sure that there's some sort of logic in where you're going to be, but there will be further information about this. Make sure that you turn up in time. We need to make sure that you are who you claim to be, therefore bring an ID. It doesn't have to be your passport, your student ID is perfectly okay. I don't know all of you personally, so we're supposed to check. Also, make sure that you can leave all your belongings somewhere else, either here at the bottom of the lecture theatre, or just don't bring it along anyway, in the first place. You're not supposed to have any kind of bags or anything. You don't need anything apart from a pen, basically. Okay. The resit will take place on 28th of September. There's sort of a half a year cycle of doing this. But let me tell you, I mean, you are theoretically, and I've said this before, allowed to do it for the first time on the 28th of September. I would very, very strongly advise against it, because it basically means that you start in your first semester putting off things, and then you're going to run into trouble later on. So unless there is a really, really good reason why you don't want to do it on the 26th of March, I would go for it in your own interest. I personally think we should be able to force you to do it, but this university thinks otherwise. So, okay, that's about the exam. Any questions about this? Yes.
Are we allowed to use the
No. No dictionary, no. For various reasons. Number one, I don't think you really need it. Number two, we would then, the regulations are like that, that we would have to check the dictionaries. And checking 250 dictionaries, no, it doesn't work. Yeah. So, no. All right, any other questions? Yes.
The complete exams part is divided into three parts, right?
Yes.
So, for those who are only writing one part because we have linguistics or literature,
yeah.
Does that mean that we are allowed to leave as soon as we finish this?
Well, oddly enough, you have the same number of minutes available for this as everyone else, which I think is a mistake. I mean, mistake. It sort of doesn't make sense that you get 90 minutes for the same thing that other people have 30 minutes, but that's the regulation at the moment. We've changed this now, but it's still valid for you. That's why I say there will be groups. We will put people who are doing minors into separate rooms, if possible, so that you don't have to sit there for 90 minutes and wait. Okay. This is a sort of a setup which is going to be difficult for some people to leave early. So we're trying our best, but basically, we have to see. Yes, there was another question. Yeah. What do you mean late?
Like there's a half year duration.
Yeah, this is, I mean, one of the main reason for this basically is that it really only makes sense to have a resit if people take it. There are minimum times that we are supposed to offer in between, but if we offer a resit, let's say 6 weeks after, and 50% of the people decide, nah, I don't feel like it, then that's okay. Which means that we would not only have to do 2 or 3 resits, but 4 or 5 or 6 or something like that until everyone has finally decided to do the exam. We can't force you to take it at a particular time. And the only way to do this, the only way to force you is to put it beyond a certain number of months. Because if you've done it the first time and it's longer than a certain number of months, then you have to take it the second time. This may sound slightly lunatic to you, but that's how it works. It's not our choice. Okay. I personally would find it a lot better if everyone had to do it on the 26th of March. Those of you who, for some reason, don't manage, will then get, I don't know, a month later or 2 months later, and then that's it. But that doesn't work like that. Okay. All right. A few words about the assignment. I've now put the results online in the form of a table with your matriculation number and the kind of mark that you would have received if this had been an exam. Okay. Not surprisingly, the results are better than last year's exam's result. Okay. Long live Wikipedia, I would also say. It became slightly boring. I mean, it was slightly boring to mark it because or grade it because either you had all worked together or you got the results from the same source, possibly Wikipedia. Your own choice, okay? I said this was an opportunity for you to test where you stand. Quite obviously, a lot of people didn't take that seriously. I don't mind. It became a bit more difficult to submit the same thing with the essay, and that's where the big differences were also shown. So quite a few people didn't quite answer the questions there. One very important point for the exam, and this is really in a way very, very silly if you don't take heed of this, if I ask you to underline something, it means that you have to take your pen and put a line under something in the answer. Otherwise, I will not count it as correct. For example, in one of the questions was, can you please underline the two things that are co-referential? If you've given me a sentence that contains, I don't know, 20 words or 2 sentences, and you don't underline, I can sort of imagine that you probably meant the right thing, but I don't know. People regularly miss out on points that they would really need simply because they don't underline. Okay, it'll say in the exam, make sure you underline. If you don't, sorry, can't help you. Okay. Also, don't forget to give examples. A few people didn't, I mean, it was a description of the phonetic symbol. They gave the correct description, but they forgot to put a word and underline where this sound is used. Just make sure you don't miss out on points in a silly way like that. Okay. most people among you, commonly agreed that hardship is a compound. It isn't. Why is it not a compound? Well, a compound is defined as two lexically free morphemes that can stand on their own. Hard, fine, can stand on its own. Ship, yeah, can stand on its own. But is hardship really a combination of the two? Hardship has nothing to do with going on a boat. Well, usually. Okay. Ship is not the kind of ship that's on the water, but compare this to hardship, friendship, stewardship, relationship, etc. Ship is a derivational suffix. Okay. That's what about 80 or 90% of people got wrong. Okay. Like in the exam last year, almost. Okay. So always think about when you decide whether it's a compound or not, decide or check whether it makes sense from the point of view of meaning, but then also from the point of view of productivity. Can you combine the same thing with other bases, and does it make, is it a productive suffix? The other thing that most people didn't quite get the way I wanted it to be was the evaluation or the analysis of fantastic performance. I asked what kind of speech act this is. And I got a lot of people who said, I don't know, this is commending someone on doing something great, etc. A lot of people just gave me one response, one particular speech act that they were thinking of. Well, they are not wrong, and you got 2 points for that. But you only got 5 points, which was the maximum, if you said, I don't know, it depends. It could mean anything. If you gave me several examples and said it depends on context, you also got full marks. Okay. But I didn't accept one definite answer, because that's the whole point. Context is everything. And without context, you can't determine it. All right? Some hints about language. Please make sure in the exam to avoid the following mistakes. An example for an indirect speech act is... This is my sort of pet mistake or pet hate mistake number one. The most important point is comma that. Pet mistake number two. And apostrophes. The cat's tail is black, its paws are white. Okay. If you haven't spotted the mistakes, you really need to look into it. Here are the mistakes. Forget example four. I know it is Beispiel für. But it is not example four in 99% of all cases. It can be example four. But if in doubt, write example of. Okay. I wonder whether this is actually going to show any effect in the exam. Usually people immediately seem to forget that again. Okay. Not every that has a comma in front of it. It's not the same as in German. Ich glaube, comma, das. I believe, comma, that. No. Okay. There can be commas before that. But if in doubt, again, leave it out. Okay. And people really don't like apostrophes here. The cat's tail has an apostrophe S, and its paws does not have an apostrophe S. And still an amazing number of people write English and German and Spanish in lowercase letters. These are the kind of things that I expect your teachers would have told you. Okay. Anyway, please make sure that you forget, that you do not provide those errors to me in the exam. Because language counts. Language counts 40%. And these are considered very, very basic errors, which will drag your mark down significantly, even if you just produce one of those. Yes?
Just a question to the exam.
Yeah.
You said all assignments must be done to be able to...
Yes.
Must be done or must be passed?
Must be done. must be done in such a way that I can see that you tried to do it. Someone submitted a second assignment and just did the first two questions. That person's matriculation number is not in the list because I consider this not done. Yeah. So if no essay is written and only two questions are, that's not it. Okay? Right. I'm running out of time because I have a lot to tell you. I'd like to do some linguistics, or rather, some corpus linguistics. And in fact, I'm going to be partly quite close to the reading, which is unusual. I'm going to repeat one or two things which are in there, but I'm also going to expand on it. I'll give you some general principles. This is basically very close to what was in the reading for today. Say a few words about compiling a corpus. Of course, I'll say what a corpus is in the first place. I'll then, and this is not in the reading, mention a few applications of corpus linguistics. Actually, I think some of it is in the reading as well, but not all of it. I'll then say something about frequency and how to measure it. I'll introduce you to two terms which are very important in corpus linguistics, namely precision and recall. And then, actually, I forgot to change this from last year, pseudo-demo. Well, it's not going to be a pseudo-demo, it's going to be a real demo, because last year I couldn't run it online. This year I'm going to do it online and show you the real thing. But I'd really like to start with asking questions that I usually ask in this context. And some of them are more silly than others, but please, if you haven't seen them before, think about the following questions. What's the meaning of goalless? You're going to be teachers, many of you. How is shall used in present-day British English? How would you teach that to your pupils? How do you explain it? What is a typical example of that, not for that? Then, think about the French. And think about what adjectives are most strongly associated with the adjective with the adjective French. Okay. Which things? French, whatever. Bread, or whatever. Okay. And then, and this is a deliberately silly question, who talks more about cars, men or women? Okay. Now, we don't really have all that much time, but can I just have a bit of feedback from you, 2-3 minutes maximum. What does goalless mean? Yeah?
Without a goal.
Without a goal, which means? You don't have a personal goal. You sort of go for a walk by the beach without, sort of aimlessly, right? Okay. Who would have said the same thing? Okay, quite a few people. Right. Any other options? No? Yeah?
Maybe very good soccer.
Okay, yes. Okay. Football, soccer. A goalless game, yeah? Now, a lot of people in this room, I'm sure, haven't thought about that, yeah? For most of you here, the idea of goalless means aimless. Okay, that's what's usually the case in German-speaking groups. Okay, what's the typical use of shall? You're given the task to teach pupils the use of shall in present-day English. What do you do? Anyone? Yeah, okay.
Maybe give a sentence.
Right, okay. Which?
Shall
we go to the theater today? Okay. Is that what everyone would have said? Any other typical sentences of how shall is used? No? Anyone else? Anything? I shall see you at 3 o'clock. Some people are nodding. Some people are shaking their heads. Okay, so we have different intuitions about this. Yes?
Because in English it's more used by elderly people.
Okay, so we have this association that it's old-fashioned, perhaps. Okay, we'll have to see. Which nouns or which words are most strongly associated with French? French what? It could come before the French No, sorry, before the French. Before the word French or after? Yes.
French fries.
Fries, okay. French?
Fiancé.
Fiancé, okay. French fiancé, okay. There's a strong, okay, all right, yeah.
French toast.
Toast, okay. Anyone else? Yeah.
French kiss.
French kiss, yes. Okay. Anything else? Well, anyway, if I had asked you to write this down, I'm quite sure I would have got, I don't know, 50 different lists. And you would all have different intuitions about what is a strong, we will call this collocation. Now, the point is, with a corpus which is a large collection or a collection of pieces of language that are selected and ordered according to to explicit linguistic criteria in order to be used as a sample of the language, with a corpus, we can provide answers to those kind of questions in a more objective way rather than tapping into our own very specific, and in the case of most of us, non-native intuitions about English. Okay. If we have a large collection of pieces of language that are suited to do this, well suited to do this because they were selected according to certain criteria and therefore can be used as representative samples of the language as a whole, we do not need to be native speakers, we do not need to rely on our intuitions, which may be faulty, which may be incomplete, which may be old-fashioned, etc., because we can look in a corpus. Okay. Now, I'd like to show you the general procedure of corpus linguistics. This is also in the reading. Let's assume I want to say something about present-day British English. For example, about the use of goalless. Well, I have a corpus, and that corpus will give me linguistic findings. I need to, we have the corpus, but someone needs to select the data, and we'll do this from all of present-day English, British English in this case. So we need to select the corpus so that we can then observe what's in the corpus. These are then our findings. And now the important step. We then don't describe, well, obviously we describe what's in the corpus, yes. But the important point is, what we are really describing then is general British English. Now, yes, we are, of course, describing what's in the corpus, but the idea is, if this is selected properly, we can say something about how it is generally used. Now, I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about selection, what it means to create a representative corpus. Representativeness is a very difficult concept. I've briefly also mentioned this in the reading. If we assume that this is our whole corpus, it's now much bigger, but it's basically still this small snapshot of the language, then we can divide this in different text types, into different text types, or different types of language uses. Okay. And some of them might be spoken English, others might be written English, newspapers, etc., etc. Now, the corpus I'm going to show you today is the British National Corpus. And I'll come back to the selection in a minute, but before, I'd like to quickly introduce you to this corpus. It's 100 million words. 100 million words sounds like a lot, but in fact, 1 million words are only a couple of books. So really, we're talking about 600-700 books only, which is a lot if you have to read it. But if you think about it, it's a collection which is supposed to represent all of British English. It's present-day English, which isn't quite true in the case of this corpus anymore because it's now about 20 years old. It's basically from the 80s and 90s of last century. It's only British English, and the makers of the corpus say that it's a unique snapshot of the English language in the sense that it captures what English was like at that time, 20 years ago, and we can select. We can then observe what's in there to draw conclusions about what an average British speaker would say. Now, we could spend quite a lot of time to think about what we would have to put into a corpus like that. And that would be an exercise that we could do if we had a small group of people. It's actually a very difficult question to answer. I think most of you will probably agree that we need spoken and written language. But how much of which? Do we need half-half? Do we need more spoken language? More written language? What kind of spoken language? Is what I'm producing now just as representative as what you produce when you chat with your friends outside? They're completely different in some ways. If we take written language, newspapers, yes. What type of newspapers? Tabloid and broadsheet, fine, but more tabloids or more broadsheets? You could say more tabloids because that's what more people read. But you could also say more broadsheets because that's more important, although importance is difficult to define here. So it's really not easy to come up with a selection of texts that is then representative. It's a fundamental concept. One important point in that context is that a corpus is not just representative. It's always representative of something, of a particular community of speakers, of a particular text type, for example, newspapers, if it's a newspaper corpus. And a technical term, which is not important for you to know by heart, is sampling frame. The people compiling a corpus will have to set up criteria so that they can select texts accordingly. Okay. They also need to define their population, the population that they need to represent. Do we want all speakers of the British Isles? Do we just want, I don't know, a certain subset? That needs to be defined beforehand, before you start compiling a corpus. Now, a lot of people are actually quite critical of this concept of representativeness because it is so difficult, because it's in a way very subjective what is typical of a language. Danny Mukherjee, colleague in Giessen, says, absolute representativeness is an unattainable aim. Or Tony McHenry from Lancaster says, any claim of corpus balance is largely an act of faith rather than a statement of fact. That doesn't sound very good. Right? That doesn't sound like this is a reliable methodology. If we can't rely on the corpus being representative, and if the results then are going to be iffy, do we really want to do it? Well, my point there is, if you know the corpus, yes, that's fine. You need to know the corpus in order to be able to know what you get out of it, or not to know what you get out of it, but to be able to interpret what you get out of it. And I'd like to exemplify that with the help of one particular example. Just before I do this, the makers of the BNC decided that they want just about half of the whole corpus to be books. All sorts of books, fiction and non-fiction. 29% is periodicals. 10.6% is spoken. So really only 10% of the whole corpus is something that most of you experience, not really experience, but produce most. Is that a question or? No, okay, sorry. And then there are some smaller parts, miscellaneous published and miscellaneous unpublished and written to be spoken. But the point is really that a fairly small proportion is spontaneous conversation and the kind of language use that I'm producing at the moment. And if you don't know this, then you can, I guess, imagine that you might come to wrong conclusions. Imagine if it was the other way around, you would get very different results. Now, the point about knowing your corpus can be very nicely explained or illustrated with what I would like to sort of call email language in the BNC, or the language of computer-mediated communication in the BNC. Remember, the BNC was compiled in the early 90s. There wasn't all that much email around, but still, it's in there. If I asked you today whether you want email language or CMC to be part of a corpus, you would say yes, definitely. But 20 years ago, of course, the internet was much less influential. But anyway, there is a bit in there. In fact, it's only 7 texts, which amounts to 213,000 words, so it was not deemed to be an extremely important part, so it's not like 10% of the corpus. And that's also in the reading. There is a very frequent word in that, and that's scum. Now, if you don't know what scum means, it means the same as Abschaum in German. Okay? Right. So you can now come to the conclusion, if you are not careful, because you are working with a representative corpus, well, in emails, the word scum is very frequent. And you would be drawing a correct conclusion on the basis of the corpus as such, perhaps, but the selection of the corpus texts is important here, because it's actually the mailing list of Leeds United supporters referring to Manchester United as the scum. So, or Manchester United supporters. So, in fact, it has nothing to do with the normal use of Abschaum or scum, but it's a very specific type of use that is conditioned by the choice of texts that were deemed to be typical of computer-mediated communication. Unless you know this, you will draw wrong conclusions. So that's why I always say, don't just use a corpus without looking at it, without finding out what's in there. You need to know that, otherwise you might come to wrong conclusions. Now, this is very obvious here, I think, but there are much less obvious cases of bias that you might miss. Okay, what is corpus linguistics? It's a method that counts. It's a method that describes. Well, describe what has been counted. Some people say it's boring because you have to count a lot of P's. Yes, you do a lot of manual work counting as well in order to get a year of data. You work with a lot of data, potentially. The idea is that you observe what happens in the language in general. The patterns that happen when you look, or that you can discern when you look at a lot of language in use. So it's not typically the aim to create a butterfly collection, as I like to call it, of all the odd things you can do with English. It really is about finding out how English is generally used. And it is based on observation, because we are observing lots of data, rather than on other ways to get data. There are other ways, like, for example, informant testing. You can walk around with a microphone and ask questions. Now, because it is a representative corpus, because we have language produced from a lot of different speakers, we therefore have language we have access to the language produced by a lot of different speakers, sort of obvious. And that makes it possible to look at language use that I would myself never be able to evaluate. I'm not a lawyer, I'm a linguist. I'm not a doctor, I'm not a coal miner, etc. They will all use language slightly differently. If my corpus covers all of this, I tap into their language use without being them myself. Okay, what do we need corpus linguistics for? What can we use them for? Okay, to do linguistics, obviously, yes, but to study linguistic competence or performance as revealed in authentic language data. There are two important words in there, competence and performance. These are words that some of you may have heard in the context of a very famous linguist called Noam Chomsky. Okay. He draws that difference between competence, which is what we have inside our heads, the very abstract model of language, or not model even, the kind of internalized knowledge of your native language. Performance is what you do with it, what you produce, the output. Okay. Now, of course, in the corpus, we have performance. We don't have competence in the corpus. But, and I'd like to make that point, and I'd like to explain why I make this point, I believe that in the corpus, you can actually investigate both performance and competence. And by competence, I mean that by looking at corpus data, you can actually try and find out what's going on in people's heads, so to speak. Chomsky would disagree. Performance is a poor mirror of competence. It is subject to external influences. Is the speaker drunk, ill, under stress? Okay. He says, a corpus is by its very nature a collection of externalized utterances. It is performance data, and it's therefore a poor guide to modeling linguistic competence. And that's what Chomsky wants to do. He wants to have a model of how language works. Introspection is far superior to the corpus approach. Well, some people disagree, myself included. Here's Jan Swartwick and Randolph Quirk. Since native speakers include lawyers, journalists, gynecologists, school teachers, engineers, and a host of other specialists, it follows that no individual can be expected to have an adequate command of the whole repertoire. Who, for example, could equally well draft a legal statute and broadcast a commentary on a football game? And B, that no grammarian can describe adequately the grammatical and stylistic properties of the whole repertoire from his, nowadays, by the way, you would have to say their, or his or her, own unsupplemented resources. Introspection as the sole guiding star is clearly ruled out. Completely different view. Now, there was a symposium about 20 years ago where a famous linguist, Charles Fillmore, tried to bridge those two views. I have two main observations to make. The first is that I don't think there can be any corpora, however large, that contain information about all of the areas of English, lexicon and grammar that I want to explore. Yeah. All that I have seen are inadequate. The second observation is that every corpus that I've had a chance to examine, however small, has taught me facts that I couldn't imagine finding out about in any other way. Now, what he suggests is that we need a combination of both. We need, on the one hand, clearly to use our introspection about language, also to find out whether something is interesting or not. Not everything that we get out of a corpus is interesting. But there are things that the armchair linguist, as some people call it, the linguist who sits back in the armchair, thinks, oh, that's a neat fact about language. I'll write a book about it. That kind of linguist can't get. There are a lot of things that just don't work like that. Now, I'd like to illustrate this briefly with one of my favorite topics, namely complex prepositions. These are animals like this, in terms of, in front of, with regard to, etc., etc. Okay. And the question is whether they're really prepositions. Are they units of language? Are they indivisible units of language which function like a single preposition? Or are they two preposition phrases? So, are they in terms of X, where we've got a preposition phrase within another a preposition phrase? Or is it really one preposition which can be used like with or of or something like that? Is there a constituent boundary or is there no constituent boundary? This is a question of competence. This is not a question of performance. This is a question about how we store complex prepositions in our minds if we are native speakers, perhaps also if we are not native speakers. Now, I can't go into great detail here, but I want to show you one thing that I did with a corpus to try and answer that question. And that gives me an opportunity to go back to things that I talked about briefly in the lecture on conversation. Filled pauses, things like or. I already told you that they're very frequent in spoken language. And I briefly mentioned why they occur, the hesitation markers in particular. They may be related to the kind of planning that goes on when we produce language online. I have held this lecture a couple of times, but I still need to make sure that I'm making coherent, for producing coherent sentences, and I've just produced a sentence that was not 100% right. I needed to self-repair. Okay? And it means that I need to think ahead what I say next, and sometimes this may be a little bit too much for me, and then I might use a filled pause. Planning, therefore, can be seen sometimes by looking at what filled pauses occur. It might also simply be hesitation, but in any case, it is fair to say, I think, that it reflects partly what's going on inside my brain. People who've looked at filled pauses have noticed that they occur at specific places, often, at specific syntactic places. Here are two linguists, Clark and Clark, back in 1977. Within sentences, these boundaries are appropriate place are an appropriate place to stop. These boundaries, the constituent boundaries, so boundaries between, for example, phrases, are the appropriate place to stop to plan details of the next major constituent. This stopping place is typically marked by a filled pause. Biber et al. 1999 say filled pauses occur at lesser or medial syntactic boundaries in addition to major boundaries. So they occur at boundaries. In other words, if we see a pause that is filled with or there is a great likelihood that this is actually some kind of boundary. Now remember the question whether complex prepositions are indivisible units or not. It's really a question whether there is a boundary inside or not. We could, if we look at filled pauses in complex prepositions, find a filled pause at the slot where some people may think there is a constituent boundary, in terms, of, or in line, with. We could also find the filled pause before and after, in terms of, And in fact, we might even find in connection with. Now, if I find a lot of instances like one, that would suggest that there is a syntactic boundary. That would therefore suggest that a complex preposition is not an indivisible unit. If I found a lot like these, then that wouldn't necessarily say anything about this boundary here, between terms and off, but if I only found these, but none of these, or very few, then I think that would be fairly strong performance data that confirms my hypothesis. And that's, in fact, what I found. I found a lot of in terms of. I found very, very few in terms of. I found just as few in terms of. And I found a lot of in terms of the thing. Now, I think Chomsky's wrong. Okay. We can deduct some, or deduce, or we can say something about what's going on in inside our brains by looking at performance data. It doesn't mean that it is always the case that we retrieve complex prepositions as units. If we want to, if we need to, we can put them together on the basis of compositional rules of syntax. But this data suggests that most people in most contexts don't need to put them together but retrieve them as single units. So we've answered a question about competence with performance data. Okay, that was one application of corpus linguistics. We can, of course, use corpora also to look at historical facts, and in fact, introspection is extremely unreliable, and text is all we have. We have native speakers of English who can tell you with some certainty that certain things are possible or not in British English today, like the people working in our department, yes. But if you ask them whether it was possible 300 years ago, they will fail miserably, because their intuitions just don't go back 300 years, they're alive now. If we have a large collection of historical texts, we can use them, and in fact it's the only way to use them, to find out about what happened back then. A lot of you are going to be teachers. And in fact, corpus linguistics has become very, very important as input for teaching materials. A lot of teaching material that you're using here at university is, in fact, based on corpus linguistics and frequencies. Let me give you my favorite example. How many of you learned this construction in school? She might have been being interviewed. Might have been being interviewed. Five elements. Yeah, some people learn that. I mean, I certainly learned it back when I was at school. Some people have teachers who still teach this. He could have been being treated in hospital. How often do you think this form, or this type of form, I mean this kind of construction, this verb group with five elements, is found in the British National Corpus, 100 million words? Not a single time. So why teach it? Isn't that wasted time? Isn't that particularly wasted time because those of you who have not learnt this at school, I think still understood what was going on. If you've understood something about the workings of the verb group or how they put together, then you can understand this even though you were never explicitly told. And you don't really need to use it anyway because it's not used. Well, it may be used, but it may be used very, very, very rarely. If you are given the fantastic task of welcoming 50 Chinese tourists in Trier and teach them as much as possible to get round Trier on their own for the next 2 weeks, you don't teach them what's unusual. You teach them the absolute basics that are highly frequent, obviously. Now, I'm not saying that frequency is the only reason in deciding what to teach, but it is a major reason, and frequencies are actually quite difficult to find out via intuition. You need corpus data for that. Okay, two major advantages of corpus linguistics. It's a scientific way of doing research, okay. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that everyone who is not using a corpus is not working in a scientific way. Okay? But it's clearly one way of doing something that is objectively verifiable. And that is a criterion for good research. You can compare findings across corpora, across similar corpora. And someone who found out something on American English might go, or someone else might go and say, let's see whether the same is the case for British English. And as long as the two corpora are comparable and both representative, then the differences that we observe can be seen to be differences between British and American English. And everyone else could do the same. It doesn't really make sense for everyone else to do it because if someone's done it, fine, but they could. And it could be verifiable. And secondly, and that's something that I've in a way already said, you don't need to be a native speaker to do really, really good work. Even if you're not a native speaker of English, can you actually find out a lot of what English is used like? And you're in a way on the same footing as someone who is a native speaker of English. Okay. Those were sort of some preliminary, some general facts about corpus linguistics, some uses of corpus linguistics. I'd now like to move over to some more specific aspects. Frequency, as I said, is important. Let's have a look at something that I counted in the British National Corpus. The frequency of the word sure. And I was interested in whether sure is more frequent in spoken or in written language. What would you think? Is it more frequent in spoken or in written language? Who is in favor of spoken? Yeah, who is in favor of written? No one. Okay, now let's look at this. We've got 5,198 instances in spoken, and we've got 18,510 in written. So were you all wrong? Where is it found more frequently in spoken or in written language. Well, yes, some people are already, yeah?
Yeah, in spoken.
In spoken, yes.
Much more.
Why?
The
exactly. Exactly, yes. Now, yes, we have this, but remember we've got 10% spoken, 90% written about. So you need to calculate frequency per million words. Now, raw frequencies can be extremely misleading. Now, I'm sure this sounds perfectly obvious to everyone in this room now. I would kind of expect. But for some reason, this is the number one error of novices in corpus linguistics. They count raw frequencies and forget the fact that it's not the same size that we're looking at. Therefore, and I've tried almost anything to try and instill this into people listening to this, therefore, just to repeat and to do it sort of step by step, I'd like to show you why. Now, I'm in a way treating you like mathematical children here, but that's simply because for some reason people don't listen or don't apply it. They only do it once. If they write a Hausarbeit and then they, I'm later telling them, yeah, but look, it's different, therefore it's exactly the opposite, and they go, oh no, and then they never do it again. Okay. But I'd like to avoid that situation. Let's assume we have two corpora. They're both 4 million words. We've got 16 instances here. We've got 4 instances here. Where is it more frequent, what we're looking at? Well, it sort of makes sense to say that in the first case, we've got 4 instances per million word, 16 divided by 4. And in the second one, we've got 1 instance per million words. Therefore, it's 4 times more frequent. Fine, yeah? Everyone with me? Same question, different corpora. First corpus, and the second one, is actually smaller. 4 million words versus 1 million words. And again we find 16 instances in the first one, and again we find 4 instances in the second one. 4 instances per million words in the first one, we've already established that. 1 million words, 4 instances. 4 instances per million words. Same frequency. Yeah? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Makes perfect sense. Yeah. Please remember this when you work with your corpus or with a corpus like the British National Corpus for the first time. For some reason, this is extremely difficult to remember. We're talking about 30% of all people working with a corpus not remembering this. Relative frequencies are required to compare findings across subcorpora, for example. This is what's called normalization. Okay. We create or we calculate relative frequencies. Okay, and as I said, it's number one error. I'd like to now look at the answers to the questions that we asked, or that I asked at the beginning. And I'd like to do this in several steps, and I'd like to show you a tool which is available to you and which you can use for free with full access if you are registering for it with your Trier University email address. Otherwise, you get only restricted access, but you can still use it for free. I'll give you information about accessing it at the end of the lecture. Now, this is actually something that, again, I forgot to delete. No live demo because the recording doesn't work. Yes, it works. Okay, so I'm going to now try and give you a live demo of this. Let's see. Oops. Haha. No. Okay, in that case, let's do it like this. I'm still going to give you a live demo. Okay. Okay. That's the tool. That's what you see when you get to the main entrance page or the main page of BNC Web. And all you basically have to do is enter goalless. Okay? And you click on start query. And then very quickly, because it's an index in the background, it doesn't need to actually search 100 million words, you are taken to what's known as a list of concordance lines, or as a concordance. And you get the file names, where in the corpus these texts are found, or these hits, and you get the hit with a little bit of background, a little bit of context, almost like a Google search. Okay. In a way, Google produces corpus output as well, to some extent. Okay. And then you can go down and you can decide, or you can try and find out whether this is about being aimless or whether it's about having no goal in a football or soccer game. Let's have a look at this. The only redeeming feature of a goalless, worthless event at Stamford Bridge was that it did not require a grant. Football or aimless? Football, because Stamford Bridge is something to do with football. If we don't know, we can click on it, and then we get the larger context. This you can't do if you are not a local user. So if you just if you use your WebDE or Google Mail or whatever address to register, you can't get access to the larger context because of copyright reasons. And you can see goalless, worthless event at Stamford Bridge. It's in a football. It's in the football section of a newspaper. This actually is a bit more difficult to read than this, which is show in quick view, which is a keyword in context view. Now you then immediately notice that there seem to be lots of goalless draws. What's a goalless draw? A goalless draw is when both teams didn't score a goal and the game ended 0-0. Okay? So it's a goalless draw. Now that suggests that all of these are actually football too, or soccer. And in fact, you can go to the end of it. By the way, it tells you that there are 86 hits, so it's a very infrequent word. It also tells you that it is found in 39 different texts, so it's not a very specific word that only occurs in one text alone. And, importantly, it also tells you a frequency per million words. And that's something that you can use to compare it against other frequencies that you get, for example, out of a subcorpus or a different corpus. You can go to the second page by clicking here. And in fact, if you're interested in what kind of text it is, you can just hover over the link, and then you can see that this is from the Daily Mirror, and you get lots of information about the text. Okay? In fact, you even get things that you may not immediately see as being very important, but they are very helpful for linguistic analysis. What you get as well is part of speech tags. For each word in the corpus, there is a tag, whether it's a noun or whether it's an adjective, and that information is also visible. But let's not go into too much detail. Now, has anyone seen any aimless meanings here? You couldn't look at this in detail, but I'll tell you that all 86 examples of goalless are to do with football. There's not a single use of goalless which means aimless. If you look it up in the OED, you find the aimless meaning. In fact, one of the Bronte sisters used it for the first time, according to the OED. It is in use, possibly, but if it is in use, and if we believe that the BNC is representative, then we can now say that it is very, very frequent, infrequent, if at all, used. The fact that it's not in the corpus doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. But you can be fairly certain that it is very infrequent. Okay, that was the first answer, and I think the point that intuition doesn't help you always is now confirmed. There's usually someone in the room who says football or soccer, and it's usually also a man, by the way, today it was a woman who said it. Okay. Right, So first thing is answered. Let's go back and answer the second question. But before I'm answering the second question, I'd actually like to introduce the two terms precision and recall. I know it's the end of term, another half an hour, please, without too much chatting, okay? Or in fact, without any chatting would be nice. Did we really find all instances of goalless? It was a very, very simple search. We just entered the word goalless. Well, someone, after using this example for quite a few years, came up to me and said, are you aware that there are actually instances of goalless in the corpus where we have a hyphen? I said, oh, no, I wasn't. In fact, there are 16. So for a long time, I had made a correct statement about the 86 instances, but I had not realized that I had not looked at all instances that are in the corpus. And there is a danger that in those 16 that we missed, there might have actually been some aimless meanings. Okay? And then I would have constantly said the wrong thing. In fact, that set me going, and I then found two instances where goalless is misspelled. Okay. So in fact, we missed 17.3% of all instances that are relevant. And that is quite a large proportion. So we need to be careful. And to measure these kind of what we miss and what we have, these two terms, precision and recall, are very important. Let's assume this is our corpus. We are interested in this green stuff. Let's say these are instances of, I don't know, a word, a construction, or something like that. Now, these are all in the corpus, but I don't know, because if I knew, I wouldn't be looking for them. Mm-hmm. Now, this is what my search retrieves, for whatever reason. It's not a perfect search. It only retrieves 20 of the 25, in the same way as I just only retrieved 86 of the over 100 instances. Now, I can now calculate the percentage of what I retrieved with respect to what is in the corpus. Recall is 80%. Okay? Unfortunately, my search algorithm isn't great because it also retrieves garbage. That's an official term in corpus linguistics. It retrieves stuff that I don't want, okay, that I would need to manually discard. In fact, I retrieved 32 instances of what might be relevant, but in fact, 12 of them are not. So only 20 of the 32 that I retrieved are relevant. So my precision, the precision of my research, of my retrieval procedure, is lower than recall, namely only 62.5%. Both is not really ideal. I'll come back to what is more, what is better in a minute. Just two definitions. Recall measures the proportion of relevant information retrieved in response to a search procedure. So the number of relevant items actually obtained divided by the total number with which would have been obtained in a perfect search. Okay? That's the definition of recall. Precision measures the proportion of retrieved items that are in fact relevant of the ones that are retrieved. The number of relevant items obtained divided by the total number of retrieved items. Precision is very easy to calculate, in a way. Recall can usually only be estimated, because if you knew how many there are in the first place, you wouldn't be looking for them. Now, just as it is very easy to, apparently for beginners, to forget about the difference between relative frequencies and raw frequencies, it is quite easy to forget about precision and recall, and that is in fact something that even experienced corpus linguists sometimes fall into this trap. Let's look at the question of shall versus will, and before we answer this, I would like to... the use of shall. Before I do this, I would like to look at the use of will, because many instances of shall can be replaced with will. Okay, I shall do this for you. I will do this for you. And shall, in fact, occurs a couple of thousand times, but for will, we have 20,000 instances. Now, let's not look too much at the difference there, but the question is, what's the precision of my search here? Have I found all instances and only the instances of will? What's the precision and what's recall? Can someone answer that? Have I found only instances of will? There might be the name will, and there might be the will as in testament, right? Okay, yes. So we're finding too much, which means precision is not 100%. More importantly, is recall 100%? We certainly found more than what we want, but I mean, most instances will be instances of the modal verb will. So, precision is 100%, it's not 100%, but still pretty good. But what about recall? Yeah? You'll be able. What is this? Apostrophe double L. This is the contracted form. Look at the frequency. Raw frequency of 31,000. Now, if you haven't thought of this, you missed about, 30,000 instances that are mostly relevant. Are you referring to the fact that will and shall could both be? No. What's your question? Exactly. Yes. Good point. Yes? Yeah. Okay. Yes. So, in fact, even that one won't give us 100% recall. And everyone in this room who hasn't or who hadn't thought of this has sort of fallen into the trap of not producing an ideal retrieval procedure and will therefore have missed 60% of all relevant cases. It's very easy to do this. Precision is typically very good when you work with lexical items. But as soon as you're looking for grammatical structures, for example, like all progressives, split infinitives, all noun phrases, all passives, etc., then it is becoming much more difficult to get good precision. And that then means that you need to sort out the relevant ones from the ones that you don't want. And that often takes time. Now, the thing in corpus linguistics to do... A long week again. The thing to do in corpus linguistics is to optimize both precision and recall. You try to get recall up to 100%, and you try to do this at the same time as not getting down your percentage of precision. That is usually difficult. If you increase the range of what you get, then you typically increase the garbage that you retrieve as part of it. What is more important if you're a linguist? Retrieving all instances or retrieving only instances that are relevant? Who's in favor of precision, of recall, of optimizing recall? Who thinks that this is more important? Yeah. Who's in favor of precision? Okay, just as few. And who doesn't know? Okay. The answer, I think, is clear. Definitely recall. If you are interested in an exhaustive description of your phenomenon, if you're not just after examples, if you improve recall, you typically reduce precision. But that is easy to deal with if you have the time. But if you only have relevant instances, but they are really only covering 10% of everything that's relevant, then you're making potentially statements about a very small part of the irrelevant data, and you may be making biased statements. So precision and particularly recall are fundamental concepts in corpus linguistics. It's very easy to miss something that you haven't thought of. 100% recall is better than 100% precision, but that usually means more work. Okay, let's look at the answers of the remaining questions. Now again, I could do this in an online demo, but I'll do this quickly and just show you the results. Shall occurs 2,700 times, so it's a lot less frequent than will and apostrophe, double L, and won't. You've got examples like shall I finish off after the break? Shall we give them a nice sweet hot of, nice sweet hot cup of coffee? Well, what I think I shall do now is I think I should take this a little further. So we have shall I, shall we, but I also have an example here of I shall, which, as you said, sounds slightly more old-fashioned. Well, I shall be interested to see what you can get. So we've got those two patterns. Shall plus personal pronoun plus shall. Which one is more frequent? Well, BNC Web gives you a nice tool where you can see distributions over different subcorpora, male versus female users, older versus younger, etc. Now, we're only looking at spoken language here, but this is, and this is the category age. This is the distribution of the 1,700 instances in the corpus for which we know information about age. And as you can see, the youngest use it most frequently, the oldest somewhere in the middle, and the second oldest group using it least frequently. What does that suggest? Age is not an obvious factor. So that would sort of go against your hint or your intuition that age is an important factor. Is this true for all users of shall, though? That's the question now. Let's look at the two constructions in separation. Here we have I shall and we shall. I shall be here at 3 o'clock for tea. Okay? The kind of thing that you would perhaps think the Queen could say. Yes, oldest speakers most frequently. Remember, the number of hits are not the important bit. The frequency per million words is the important information. Second oldest, third oldest, fourth oldest, fifth oldest, youngest. So that is confirmation of your intuition that shall in the I shall, we shall construction is old-fashioned. Yes, older people use it most. Youngest users' frequency is, in fact, 5 times lower. 160 versus 28 per million words, almost. Okay. Let's look at the opposite, or let's look at the alternative construction. In fact, you see that it's just the opposite. The youngest people use shall I, or shall we, most. Second youngest, well, and second and third youngest, very close. And then the oldest use it least frequently. So, and again, we've got a factor of 5. This suggests that just looking at the word shall is not enough. We need to look at how shall is used in which grammatical construction. Shall I help you is, of course, a polite suggestion or an offer, while I shall do this is, of course, something completely different. So shall is not necessarily old-fashioned. It's not necessarily dying out, as some people say. It is commonly used. But there are marked differences between the use in polite offers, suggestions in the form of interrogatives, and its use in declaratives. And this is likely to become more pronounced in the future because we can interpret this data as a snapshot of language change in progress. Once the oldest people are no longer, and the middle-aged are old, and the young are middle-aged, perhaps the whole thing has moved further into whatever extreme we are seeing. Okay, that was the second question. Let's talk about the French and French kisses and those kind of things. And I'll go back to using the interface here. Let's go for a new query. French. Notice that I spelt French with a capital F as another hint. Okay. Now, we could now look at all 16,000 hits, or in fact almost 17,000 hits, and we would say things like, find things like French taste, French historian, French artist. In fact, this is very dangerous because the corpus is not ordered randomly. We would always, and many of them are from the same text. That's why it's really quite important to look at this in random order. There is a button for this as well. Ah, French food is here. Okay. French economy, French assistance. It would take us a long time to work out. And in fact, there is a tool which we can use to do this, and that's called the collocation feature. When in doubt, just accept the defaults. What it basically does is that in the background, it now builds up a database of all the words that happen before and after, and it then calculates how strongly they are associated with each other. You don't need to know the details of this at the moment. If you are interested, I can direct you to sources that explain how this works. So we get the result that the is very strongly associated with French. But also things like German, revolution. Did anyone think of revolution? You think of French kisses, you think of French fries, you don't think of French revolution. Hardly anyone I've asked this question actually says revolution. In fact, we can restrict it to nouns, and we can even restrict it to the nouns following French by setting the window, the collocation window. This is currently from three before to three after, but we can set it to one after to three after. So this will find a lot of instances of French noun. Let's have a look. And then you can see that revolution is the strongest. Government. German. Let's have a look. We just click on those 113 instances. He learned French and German. Yeah, okay. So French is not actually an adjective here. True of the French, German, Russian, and British governments. Yeah, so you can see some perhaps unexpected, and maybe also not linguistically very interesting results. But a lot of French and German are mentioned together. French windows. It's a special type of window. Actually a door to go out on the patio. French franc, okay, 20 years ago. Nowadays, euro. Okay. French troops, French minister. French Mitterrand. Yeah. So we've got certain political figures which at that time, or who at that time were important. And again, you need to know when the corpus was compiled in order to make sense of this. You see a lot of political or international vocabulary here, troops, army, etc. This suggests that the selection of texts is very important here, or it's a reflection of the text, because there are a lot of newspapers in there, and they will, of course, report about French armies or French, no, sorry, French ministers or whatever, rather than French fries. Okay. If you're interested in French kiss, we can enter kiss. And then you can see that there are only five instances of French kiss in the BNC. Now, that doesn't mean that people don't use French kiss, but it seems that if you look at the language as a whole, French kisses are actually not so important. Okay. You may, of course, have very personal other views about this, but that's not how the language is used in general. Okay. That was the answer to the second question. No, the third. actually, while I'm at it, and since I still have a few more minutes, I know this is getting rather long, but let me just show you one other thing, which I sometimes show in this context. What can be caused? You cause what? You cause
an accident.
Heartbreak. Okay. Trouble.
Confusion.
Gosh, are you negative? Yeah? Can you not cause happiness? Can you cause bliss? Some people think they can cause bliss. Okay. Let's see. Now, there is actually a way to look for all instances of the verb cause as a verb. For all word forms of the word cause as verb. This will give me quite a lot of hits, 20,000 instances. Okay. I'm now again using the collocations feature. I'm calculating collocations, and I'm again setting the window of +1 to 3, and I say only nouns. Damage, problems, harm, trouble, injury, concern, death, distress, confusion, disruption, difficulties, pain, stir, havoc, pollution, loss, chaos, delays, embarrassment, deaths, etc. Yes, negative, very clearly negative. You were right, but there are native speakers who, when asked this question, will actually be perfectly happy with neutral or even positive terms. So, cause happiness. Well, 2 instances in the corpus. It is possible. Cause bliss. Nah. Okay. Yeah. So that was quite surprising to some people, and it shows the particular semantic prosody that the verb cause has. And if you want to say something more positive, then you probably use a different verb. Yes. Don't know. Seven instances caused anti-mass feeling, okay. Caused ill feeling between officials, causing ill feelings and low morale. Causes a feeling that Antonio is, after all, immoral. Lots of negative stuff. Yeah. So, in fact, there is increase in there as well, which sounds positive, but if it's an increase in skin cancer, then it's rather negative. Yeah? So I'm not saying that it cannot be used positively, but it's very, very negative in general, and there might be other words, verbs needed that you need to use if you want to say something positive. Again, that's something that I think would be difficult to find on the basis of intuition entirely, particularly the ranking of negative things. Final question. Who talks more about cars? Okay. What I did was I looked for the word car. And surprisingly, women talk more about cars. Okay. 485 versus 361 per million words. Have I done it correctly? Have I answered the question? Yes. Okay, that is, well, okay, actually, this is the number of words that are produced by women. This is the number of hits. As you can see, there are actually more hits by men. But because there are more words spoken by men, the frequency is lower. So that's not an issue. Okay. Yes? Yeah, you. Yeah.
Okay. Maybe male or men talk more about a specific car, like my Ferrari is broken.
Yes.
My car is broken.
Okay, yes, maybe they do that. Okay.
Yes,
exactly, yes. I mean, this is of course a silly question. Yeah. But yes, maybe men, I mean, women are supposed to be a lot better at colors. Maybe men are better at car brands. I don't know. This is, in fact, we are, of course, I should at least have looked for cars as well. I only looked for the singular. Yeah? But maybe they talk about Yeah, Ferraris and Porsches and whatever. And therefore would also be talking about cars. If you talk about a car boot sale, is that talking about cars? Not really. In fact, there are many ways to refer to cars without using the word car. So this basically cannot be answered with a corpus. Now this is a deliberately silly question to show the point that the methodology is very good for certain things, but not necessarily very good for other things. And you need to be aware of that. Okay. We could have a corpus where semantic tags are attached to every single word and maybe there is a category cars. Then we could do it, but we don't have that. Okay, if you want access to the BNC, as I said, it's free. If you go to this interface, to this address, bncweb.info, then you click on the link access to the BNC via BNC Web at Lancaster University, which is my old university, as some of you know. Then you need to register for an account. It'll send you an email. Use your university Trier address, otherwise you will get limited access, and you then access the tool at this address. Okay, and that's the end of it. See you in March, many of you. This is what the university exam looks like in Britain. It's going to look differently here. It'll still be an exam. See you then, and good luck.